I'd like to officially welcome everyone. My name's Dao Tran. I'm from Brooklyn, New York, and I work with a nonprofit called Voice of Witness, and we do oral history collections, a couple of which I brought, and one of which I think I might be reading from. So they're all available in the Haymarket room. We're here today to talk about literature as a tool for abolition. I'm going to do just a quick formal bio introduction for Darnell, and then a little bit of a special introduction that we figured out. So Darnell Moore is head of strategy and programs at Breakthrough US, which is a media hub that does work for social change. He's the author of this fantastic book, hardcover, paperback, No Ashes in the Fire, Coming of Age, Black and Free in America, which was listed as a 2008 New York Times notable book. It's where I learned about it last year. There was a very good review, I thought. And winner of the Lambda Literary Award for Best Gay Memoir / Biography in 2019. He's the co-managing editor at the Feminist Wire, and an editor of the Feminist Wire book series, coming out of Arizona Press. He's a writer in residence at the Center on African American Religion, Sexual Politics, and Social Justice at Columbia. We both hail from New York, and it's really been a pleasure to get to know you, Darnell. This book really traces, revisits, really, you know, your history, your personal narrative, and touches on some of the traumas that have affected you. And I think, you know, in tracing some of that, you do this amazing job of contextualizing it also historically, the city of Camden, your upbringing there, your family, and just the special bio, which you won't read in most places, and you will read in the book, is I asked Darnell for a couple words that he would want to share, you know, that describe him or a descriptive phrase, and his was born black and loved in Camden, New Jersey. And that to me is, you know, something special. You don't necessarily get to hear that part of someone's bio, and it's hopefully something that we can unpack a little bit more in our conversation today. So I'd love to start, if you can, with just reading from some of your books so people get a taste.
Sure. So first of all, is it morning?
It's still morning, yeah.
Anyway. Good morning.
Good morning.
If you don't mind, if there's somebody in the room you don't know, can you just turn and say hi to that person? Just acknowledge their presence.
Hi.
So I had to do that for three reasons. One, it was just too damn quiet in here and I couldn't take it. I mean, I get what type of speech, I'm like, these are my intellectual friends, you know, peers here, but I want to break the room up a little bit. Secondly, because I'm an introvert and I'm always nervous, so I'm like, if I'm going to be nervous, you all going to be nervous too. And third, I really am a believer in a practice of a politic as being a bit more important than the talk of one. So yeah. And we can talk a little bit more about that. But I'm going to read, just as a sort of way to frame this, the part that I'm reading, just for those who may have, in your own life, experienced any aspect of violence or antagonism because of your existence in the world, however that existence might be understood, this is me hearkening back to one of those memories, so I want to apologize in advance if this triggers. But I also want you to take heed to how I end this particular reading, how I reimagine the person, the perpetrator in this case, the person who might have harmed me, and what you think I might be trying to do through that reimagining. Our street was usually tranquil in the late spring, especially after school. The hot sunlight would shimmer on the tiny glass shards left from broken bottles on the cement sidewalk. The neighborhood kids would be inside acting as if we were doing homework or playing games on our Nintendo, our Sega systems, while our caregivers made their way back to homes full of people, problems, love, and concern. from the even the fearless street pigeons, fiercer than any stray dog that chased passerbys for fun, seemed to be reserved that day. Why are you such a fucking faggot? OB, the oldest and toughest of the crew, asked as he uncoiled the plastic cup cap covering the milk jug he held in his hand. The boys walked toward me and surrounded me before I was able to make it home. OB's taunts were routine. By 14, I had perfected the art of indifference. Slurs like gay and pussy would be met with a giggle and smirk as if they did not cut. My smile was fraudulent. I held back tears and swallowed the stinging embarrassment. Faggot. My heart started racing. I was standing a few feet away from my grandparents' house, but the boys were blocking my movement on the sidewalk. The uncovered milk carton was nearly full, but I realized it didn't contain milk. I could smell gasoline. And I wondered if it had come from a small yellow moped my uncle had given me. My bike had been stolen several days before. The rumor circulating on the block was that Obi had taken it. I was actually relieved when it disappeared because I was too scared to take it for a ride. You scared pussy? What you gonna do? Obi asked. I didn't have a response. I never did when he or anyone else hurled insults. This time, however, I sensed Obi wanted to do more than taunt me. He started pouring the gasoline on me, but before he could finish, I pushed him away. I was thin and lacked definition. Obi was fit. I only shoved him to keep him from hurting me. I was too frightened and caged in by their bodies to inflict harm. Obi was pissed. Within seconds, he emptied the gasoline on my head. The liquid covered my body. I could barely see. My eyes were glazed and throbbing, the pungent smell of fuel, which belonged in a moped tank and not a child's mouth, heightened my senses. The block was eerily silent. The wind seemed to have stopped whistling. The cars blazing loud rap songs on woofer speakers seemed to disappear. I was dazed. I felt hands, many hands, violently hammering my body. I caught a glimpse of Obi as he attempted to strike the match. It flickered several times. However, the wind instinctively seemed to put out each flame, and he grew even angrier. His handsome, caramel brown face lost its look of youthful innocence. His forehead was furrowed and his eyes were slightly squinted. He looked disappointed. He seemed defeated because he could not light the match. He was unable to watch me burn. I was in shock and emotionally numb. The psychic pain was so deep I could no longer sense his presence. I barely remembered Mark, Fuji, and the stranger were ever there. I was focused on OB and his matches in hands, and death felt close. Skipping. All these years later, I still don't understand what would provoke OB. What made him so angry he would want to kill me? I knew little about his family and personal life, but I knew enough. I knew the immense poverty he and his siblings endured, and I knew that the violence that had become mundane in our neighborhood had begun to shape him the same way it had started to shape me. I shed fewer and fewer tears every time I was told another young person had been murdered in my neighborhood. People died often. Maybe OB and I were more often alike than I wanted to believe. Skipping again. I placed my bet on my mom when I confessed my truth to the black woman from the black hood who at the time lacked a high school diploma. I placed my bet on the strange black man in Newark whose only way of signaling his internal angst was by calling me a faggot. I placed my bet on the many wise black leaders who saw what I did not, those willing to lose whatever monetary gifts had been dangled before them for the sake of just treatment, and whether I would win or lose, the outcome mattered less than the intention to believe in and radically love black people in a world where we have been denied love, black love. Shared by so many is the reason I'm here breathing, fighting, dreaming, surviving, working, even when we start the fires that have consumed so many of us. I remember who handed us the gasoline, the matches, and the inclination to hate our reflections. OB got his tools from the same place I got mine. We were the same, despite the fact that we were different, that we made different choices. To this day, I search for any traces of Obi's life on the internet. I don't know if he's alive, and if he is, I don't know if he's well, but I want him to be free. No more ashes, no more fires, only love, and the unbridled urgency to build a world where the edges are imagined as a starting place for Black liberation now and always.
As you were reading that, one of the things that came to mind was this quote by Arundhati Roy that some of you may be familiar with. I thought I'd want to share just quickly. There's really no such thing as the quote-unquote voiceless. There are only the deliberately silenced or the preferably unheard. And to me that, you know, it says a lot about personal narrative and the importance of writing it, creating it, and also the importance of seeing how it can be connected to, you know, social justice, to, I mean, we weren't gonna actually say the word abolition too much in this conversation, because part of I think what we were getting at is that's the overarching frame, but it sometimes can be more effective if it isn't said explicitly. Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll unpack that a little bit more in this conversation. But the other thing that I was thinking of was part of the immense power, I think, and the transformative nature of personal narrative is how it helps you to get a little bit closer to people through their stories. I think about, you know, just what you just read, and we put ourselves there with you. We're there next to you as this assault is taking place. And because we're hearing directly from you, it's harder to turn away in a sense. Mm. And you know, I think part of it, you're making yourself vulnerable, and that through that vulnerability, we have access to, you know, making ourselves vulnerable at the same time and sharing that with you. Can we talk a little bit about your, like how you came to write this? Because there is, I think, there are some memoirs that don't do what you did, where it's just internal and sort of nasal gazing. And I think it doesn't put things in context, but can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So just as a way to enter, to sort of respond to that question first, one of the reasons why I shared and read that story first, I tend not to read that at all, just because it's, when you're a Black writer writing about spaces like Camden, New Jersey, it's like people always want the depressing shit first, you know? But there, what I was trying to do with this particular narrative is really challenge the reader, and I was challenged as a writer, in trying to really, how do you write into being the humanity of even those who might have scarred you? And we're talking about abolition. So abolition, I want us to sort of keep that in the backdrop as we're having this conversation. If you're really about the project of abolition, which is why I think any of us who say that we are abolitionists should be really clear about what we mean when we say that, then it means that I had to grapple with, as a writer, this politic that I was holding on to, this politic that was pushing back against disposability of the easily disposed of, a politic that refused to see humanity in people who may have made wrong choices, who may have harmed others, a politic that was asking of me to think beyond systems of retribution and punishment and carcerality as a way of transformation. So as I'm writing, I'm like, oh shit, this is where like the rubber meets the road. You're writing a story about OB and you claim to have this abolitionist politic. How are you gonna write OB into being? And it meant that I had to sit and grapple with the complexity of that. He hurt me and he was also hurt. We lived on the same street. in Camden, in the moment when our streets were ravaged, not just by drugs, but by the sort of law enforcement bodies that had found reason to sort of over-criminalize us for that. I knew that he lived in a home that was overpopulated with people, and I knew that he lacked the type of food security, the type of housing security, the type of access to safety and educational opportunities that so many people did. And it wasn't until I was writing that story where I had to sit with his interiority, which didn't mean I like so easily forgave or, you know, like I just got over the trauma. It meant that I was able to uphold him in a different way as a character in a book. And it meant that I had to reimagine what justice might look like. And today what I know is OB would have never been served, never been changed by being placed in anybody's jail cell. Cages cannot fix us. Yeah, so that I just wanted to start and acknowledge that. But to say that this was it was a really hard process because as I'm writing a book, at every turn, I had to ask questions of myself, not only as a writer, but as a person in the world who had been committed to this abolitionist practice. And really, my father died while I was writing a book. You should know that I had a very complex relationship with him for a majority of my life. He had me at 15, my mom 16, so I got to see him grow up. I saw him at his worst and his best. I really remembered the worst. And when he died, it was so hard. I actually stopped writing for a month because I just couldn't deal with all the complex feelings that were coming up. Because I had this sort of one little part of me that was ghosting me that kept saying, get to know your dad, who used both hands to do violently and beautiful things. That was hard, y'all. It's hard to try to figure out or try to sit with the humanity of someone who you watched beat your mom. But then I started interviewing his people and asking him who was the 15-year-old boy who was socialized to become the adult man who thought the power of fist was the way that you somehow level a home, or at least care. And that process was transcended for me, and it really did test the boundaries, or at least the limits of the politic that I thought I was holding on to. But to answer your question, I didn't want to write a memoir, partially because I felt like it was a narcissistic endeavor. You know, like there's this way that writers tend to write themselves and fully as like a hero or a victim, you know? But I wanted to also not just grapple with the humanity, interior lives of the people in the book. I wanted to grapple with my own shit. So in the book, what I found myself doing, I loved as a kid talking about how horrible my father was. Because it just made me feel good about myself. I'm like, there is no worse example of a dude that I know than this motherfucker right here. And that made me feel so good about myself, because I'm like, that means I must be damn near perfect. As long as I'm not like him, I'm like going to social justice heaven up in his mind, you know? until he dies, and I'm writing his life on paper, and realize that we are the same. We are the same blood and the same sinew, that we are constructed by the same system that is patriarchy. That we have learned the same things. And I said, this is why I held him up as the monster, because what that allowed me to do is refuse to look in the mirror and see the monsters in me. That's how this works. Y'all do realize we come to conferences because we feel like we the shit. We in this room think that we the shit. We are able to name whose feet are on our necks, but we do not like naming whose necks our feet are on. And that's the work that this made me do. It made me analyze my fucking feet on somebody's neck, on somebody's wheelchair. And then I had to go, well, what do? You take them motherfuckers. I cuss a lot, y'all. No, I don't care. I'm sorry. You take them off. I just realized that just now. I'm like, this is a very polite room. I shouldn't be cussing. It's 11:30.
No, they haven't spoken yet.
Okay. But anyway, so the book was really a reckoning in the way that I think a lot of sort of current writers, particularly, and I appreciate black cisgender male writers who have been, can't say layman and heavy, is another book where the writer is actually centering themselves as a subject of reckoning, as a subject of critique, which is really, really important. Survival Math is another book that is out, Mitchell Jackson book, where that work is being done, where you have writers who are not just trying to analyze the people in their lives or the systems that creates the people, the communities, but also self. I didn't want a book where I had to sort of be so vulnerable. I wanted to write like cultural criticism, social history, you know, because we think that that's objective. We know it's not, but there's a way that you sort of hide the heart in easier ways. That's what I wanted to do. But I found that story, that narrative, that the uses of sort of story without ever using the word patriarchy. You know, I never use the word intersectionality. But I tell you about my mom who had me at 16, who was forced to stop going to school, who's growing up in Camden, who has to get on welfare, and goes once to the welfare office to get renewed and hits the fucking glass door and busts her head. If that's not intersectionality, I don't know what else is, right? So I figured out a way, how do we get folk to move beyond the rhetorics, which for so many of us are empty. We say them, but we don't mean them. We don't want them. I wanted people to feel. To have an effective experience, a heart-spirited experience that moves us beyond just the sort of theoretical spaces that we like to exist in, that doesn't really demand of us a reckoning, that doesn't demand of us to feel, and I wanted them to have an experience. So that, like you said, you can be at that space with me, watching that happen and realize, guess what? That you have stood and watched somebody else go through this in so many parts of your own life. I have too. So that's what brought me to, you know, to this sort of book in the way that I wrote it and why I did.
Thank you for that. So one of the ways that I think we can have an effect also in our work day to day is kind of flipping that script about who gets valued as, you know, someone who can speak on a topic, an issue, and in particular on our own lives, mm-hmm. right? That, you know, when I think about, you know, the massive, I like the human rights reports that come out. I think they're very useful, you know, for our work. But a lot of times what happens is, you know, people get interviewed for them and then a sentence or two from their lives gets extracted, taken out and put into this report, and it's dry and it's not affecting in the way that you were talking about. There's a purpose for that, but I think in many ways when you're talking about doing this through a literary lens or an artistic lens, it can be much more effective because you think the difference between a human rights report and a novel. Like the reason a lot of us read the drama, the tension, the textural details about how something, you know, sounded, looked, and felt are actually ways, access points, right, for us to reconsider sometimes, you know, what we've witnessed. I hope this is okay. I've been, you know, reading, I just started this beautiful book by Ocean Vuong, and you are familiar with him as well, and the whole thing about reckoning with the people in our lives who we love and who love us, but who are also, you know, the cause of harm. Mm-hmm. I think there's a section in this. He writes this book as a letter to his mom, and it is fiction, but it's autofiction, I guess you can call it. I just want to read a little bit because there's, mm-hmm. I think, an interesting point of connection. The time, while pruning a basket of green beans over the sink, you said out of nowhere, "I'm not a monster, I'm a mother." What do we mean when we say survivor? Maybe a survivor is the last one to come home, the final monarch that lands on a branch already weighted with ghosts. The morning closed in around us. I put down the book. The heads of the green beans went on snapping. They thunked in the steel sink like fingers. "You're not a monster," I said. But I lied. What I really wanted to say was that a monster is not such a terrible thing to be. From the Latin root monstrum, a divine messenger of catastrophe, then adapted by the old French to mean an animal of myriad origins, centaur, griffin, satyr. To be a monster is to be a hybrid signal, a lighthouse, both shelter and warning at once. I read that parents suffering from PTSD are more likely to hit their children. Perhaps there's a monstrous origin in it after all. Perhaps to lay hands on your child is to prepare him for war. To say possessing a heartbeat is never as simple as the heart's task of saying yes, yes, yes to the body. I don't know. What I do know is that back at Goodwill, you handed me the white dress, your eyes glazed and wide. Can you read this, you said, and tell me if it's fireproof? I searched the hem, studied the print on the tag, and, not yet able to read myself, said, yeah. Said it anyway. Yeah, I lied, holding the dress up to your chin. It's fireproof. Days later, a neighborhood boy riding by on his bike would see me wearing that very dress. I'd put it on thinking I would look more like you in the front yard while you were at work. At recess the next day, the kids would call me freak, fairy, fag. I would learn much later that those words were also iterations of monster. Sometimes I imagine the monarchs fleeing not winter, but the napalm clouds of your childhood in Vietnam. I imagine them flying from the blaze blasts unscathed, their tiny black and red wings jittering like debris that kept blowing for thousands of miles across the sky so that, looking up, you can no longer fathom the explosion they came from, only a family of butterflies floating in clean, cool air, their wings finally, after so many conflagrations, fireproof. That's so good to know, baby. You stared off stone-faced, over my shoulder, the dress head to your chest, the dress held to your chest. That's so good. You're a mother, Ma. You're also a monster. But so am I, which is why I can't turn away from you, which is why I've taken God's loneliest creation and put you inside it. Look.
Wow.
He's also a poet, so yeah. I think that's evident from, this is his first novella, but reactions, thoughts.
Oh my gosh.
So first of all, Ocean's words are stunning. I mean, you know you're doing some really magical stuff when you can turn, when you can make us fall in love with monsters, but I've been struggling with, in a moment right now where so much of what we are in sort of large scale collectively imagining as justice is just really fancy dressed up notions of punishment as is the American way. So what do we mean when we say justice? And I really want us to parse that out and really begin to ask ourselves what justice means. And it's really hard because I have people who get really mad when they read this book. I had friends who really, he couldn't finish it. And he said precisely that he was unable to finish it because he felt like I was too forgiving. And I told him that it wasn't that forgiveness was just something that I offer so like willingly. I practice what I call costly grace. Costly grace, not cheap grace. Cheap grace, let me give you an example. The cheap grace is the American way. Cheap grace is, you know, we enslave your people for 400 years. We have the sort of afterlives of slavery and expect you to be grateful to the nation state. Cheap grace is, you know, like a person walking into an AME church and shooting and killing black parishioners as they worship, and then a sort of a nation and a public applauding the survivors for quickly forgiving and praying for the person who harmed them. That's cheap grace. Costly grace is a type of grace that is deeply grounded in notions of accountability. It means that the harmdoer, one, comes to a point where they know they have done harm and is willing then to stop doing harm. And it's that process through which you can sort of offer the type of grace that I think costs something. So that is to say, like, you know, when I'm sitting here wrestling with my father in his book and wrestling with OB, or the man on the train who says he wanted to shoot me, or any of these folk, one, you know, part of me was just, I had this thing where I'm like, look, to be black in the context of the U.S. is to already be at the ready for disposability any damn way. That's the first reason I'm an abolitionist. You want to get fucking rid of me anyway. I am not going to aid the system in that process. That's just a rule of thumb. So part of me then means, how do I afford, even to the person who done harm, particularly these, and I'm thinking these are black folk in this book, who are already seen as something other than sort of like fully complex human beings anyway. How do I fully, similar to this sort of passage, I write, before I tell you that my dad did harm in the book, while you hear it sort of read it in the prologue, I tell the story about him teaching me how to bathe when I was 8. So notice, he had me at 15, so this would mean he was like 23. So we're like really two young black boys in a bathtub naked. And I really wanted to open up with this image of these two black boys, really, in this sort of bathtub naked, him using hands to teach me how to wash. There's no violence, it's only beauty. And then I invite the reader to sort of see how he uses his hands in other wise ways. But part of why I did that is because I know from the gate, to know that a black boy in a city like Camden has a kid of 15, you're already imagining him as something other than a human being. The reader. You're imagining him as a monster anyway. So I want to sort of challenge myself, I want to challenge them. I want to sit in a gray, I want to sit with complexity. And I also, a part of what abolitionism demands, and I think it's important to say this and how I come to think about it, I always name Ruthie Wilson Gilmore in spaces because it's her notion of abolitionism that grounds my work. So Ruthie talks about abolitionism not only as the ability to name, to deconstruct, to remove the thing that harms us, but to imagine what needs to go in the place of the thing that harms us. Do you get that pivot? So abolitionism is as much of a, what Robin Kelly would call a freedom dreaming process as it is one of deconstruction. Yeah. That is an artistic endeavor. Hence, which is why Robin Kelly in the book, Black Radical Imagination and Freedom Dream, really talks about the uses of art and literature. It's in those spaces where we can conjure, where we can dream, where we can vision what Jose Esteban Muniz would call the not yet here. The not yet here. Isn't that what abolitionism is? What is it that we know we need and deserve that we don't yet have? What do we need outside of law enforcement bodies in our community? Outside of the 911? What do we need outside of all these, outside of the jails and prisons? And part of what literature allows us to do, whether it is fiction or nonfiction, is to dabble in that creative, imaginative, expansive space. And to, as Sean Crawley talks about the otherwise, to dance with the otherwise. To be fearless about engaging in the otherwise. What are otherwise possibilities? If jail is all that anybody thought that someone like my dad or Obi belonged to, which by the way never worked, because my daddy went back lots of times, and I took a lot of those buses, those school buses with the bars on the outside of them to get there to see a young boy becoming a man who was not at all being rehabilitated. What did we need outside of that? Well, we needed a community, but this is the way I think about it, and this is what writing allows me to do. I kept thinking, okay, if we didn't have to call the police, what would we have called? The reason why I called the police and we needed my mother to be safe, right? So I'm like, what if we had a safe number in my neighborhood? Like every time you call this number, there's a bunch of people, like maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 people who have been sort of like taught to de-escalate. First thing is to always make sure that mom is safe and that dad is out of the house. That whatever he is needing to sort of not aggress is being provided to him. So I'm thinking about this as I'm writing, and I'm thinking that part of what we can do within literatures is to create the otherwise. It is to that's why Afrofuturism is so important. It's why Octavia Butler's work is so important, right? Like they are able to sort of tap into the otherwise. So that's my reaction. That's a lot of reaction to that, wasn't it? Just a lot of, that was a winding reaction, but. That's, I guess that means Ocean's work is pretty powerful, yeah.
What's your reaction to that, this?
A lot, Well, a lot. I mean, part of it is, I'm a child of refugees, sort of a refugee myself, but, you know, I came here to the U.S. when I was quite young, so not actually remembering from me directly the place where I'm from. But part of what I find so appealing about Ocean's work and writing and people who work in this kind of space between social criticism and anthropology and oral history and self-biography is that there are so many stories, right? But which ones are the ones that get heard? Mm. Which ones are the ones that people have access to? So I'm thinking, like, when I first read, I don't know how many of you know that novel, The Sympathizer, by Viet Thanh Nguyen. He was the first time that I read in a book someone who had an alternative understanding of the U.S.'s role in the in Vietnam and the war there, in a big sort of public space. Mm. I mean, there are people, you know, around me, my eighth grade social studies teacher, friends growing up, some parts of my family, but not all. And it was, to me, it was so amazing that something that I felt instinctively growing up, like this sense of anti-imperialism, or you know, knowing that what the United States was doing and had done was wrong, but never getting that validated in any other kind of space. So I think the narrative scarcity that then makes it seem like if you're gonna write about, say, the Vietnamese American experience or the African American experience, you have to do it in a way that isn't nuanced, because you're being representative. Mm. You've got this platform. And so I think that's a really tough place to write from, because you would not be being honest if you flattened it in that way, right? Mm-hmm. You wouldn't be representing, you know, the complexity. One of the things that I love that is obvious in that book, The Sympathizer, is that the Vietnamese characters are totally flawed. You know, the sort of thing that most dominant writers, white writers, get to take for granted is that they can be assholes, and you know that's not part of, you know, the body of literature, the body of work that's out there that gives people a sense to be fully, you know, gross. In the they can be not just good, right? Yeah. That's something that, you know, is part of. If you're truly fully human, then you are probably a lot of different things,
yeah,
and not necessarily just positive. But can you talk a little bit? So you didn't use the term restorative justice. I'm curious if you, if that's an implicit critique of that, or if there is, it's just more of not wanting to necessarily call that, but that's what it is.
Yeah, I mean, I was just trying. I didn't use that word, the term restorative justice, in the book. I really was trying my best to move away from rhetorics and these terms, and really trying to write into being a life world of the people, at least my people, the people I grew up with, and to offer some possibilities. I don't have a critique of restorative justice. I kind of do, these restorative justice frameworks that we use. But yeah, I don't know if I just didn't want to use it in the book.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about, you've been on book tour for a year now?
Oh God.
I'm very curious, different audiences, different responses to your work. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us some stories from that?
It's been, so I have had a couple things, some insights. It's been really amazing to have traveled for a year around the world, actually. And to find audiences that are open to the types of conversations I've been interested in engendering. The biggest of which, and I think the thing I've been most moved by, is the fact that I've been able to engage young people, and a lot of them. And there's a way that we, you know, I wrote this book for like a 15-year version of me. You know, like when I was writing, I literally, this is going to sound a little weird, but this is what I did as a writing practice. As I would write, I would close my eyes and imagine that I was standing in the back of a theater, looking at the back of a little boy's head, like a little nappy little head,
and I would be looking at, and that's who I would write to, this little black boy. And so it's nice to know that young folk have had access to the book. They have lots of questions, even so much so that just 2 weeks ago, a young person from New Orleans wrote a dramatic interpretation of the book and won in a national debate and speech tournament for dramatic interpretation. So he was texting me on Instagram like, oh my God, like I just killed this shit, you know? But his mother, you know, his mom was writing me like, oh, she just wrote me yesterday, like, you know, how many young people who are queer, black women, you know, these kids are out here reading this work and it's saving them. He also said, like, if you make a movie, I need to star. He killed it, though. Like, he's like, totally going to be 17-year-old me, you know? But, like, I've been so taken by that. You write words because you love words, and you want to somehow use those words to absolutely create ripple effect. But a young person, 17-year-old, comes to you and sends you a video of them performing your text. I don't know, I cried. I was just like, I mean, yeah, you know, New York Times notable list was dope. You know, that was like, oh shit, I wrote a book about Camden and black people and it made the list, you know? A Lammy Award was great. All of the things that have been afforded, I mean, it was a Barnes and Noble's Discover Great New Writers pick. The big thing that my mom was most excited about, it was like an O magazine as a summer reader. She was like, all that other stuff is cute. But like, give me copies of that mag. So that was nice, but like, you know, she's from Canada. Like, that stuff matters to her. Like, Essence magazine. But to know, like, these young people have really, that somebody can read these words and possibly not, they can shave off 10 to 20 years of self-hate, of shame, and possibly live, you know, like, in more free, more liberated ways that I was unable to, means the world to me. Now, it does mean, like, when you're out here, like, I hate to use the term self-care. I just hate that, because I, you know, just one can never really care for self alone. Like, there's self and community care, which means that there's a responsibility for the audiences to also be thoughtful about the work, the labor that writers who are really trying to write, as Sarah Schulman says, difficult memoirs, must do. Like, to get up here and read that passage in front of you means I'm committing myself to the task of unraveling before you. Of inviting you into, a trauma, and there's a way that we can't spectacularize that, or use it to feed this deep desire in us, because there is one, particularly when it comes to black pain. I've had to manage that, but it's been freeing. I've had less book talks and more of, I've watched rooms be transformed into spaces where we can reckon, where people can sort of wrestle and ask difficult questions and plant seeds for transformation. That's been great. It's been great to see. Yeah.
Before we get into some questions and comments from the audience, just one last thing I wanted to ask you. Do you consider what you did in this book to be a form of writing and practice that's trauma informed? And then also, what does it mean? Like, what do we do with this after it's read? You know, it's written, it's read, shared. What do we do with it? And I think maybe I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but I'm gonna guess that a lot of people are wondering, you know, what's the connection between literature and actual social change?
So trauma-informed, that for some reason that always gives that term, it just feels so non-profit-y, you know, like trauma. But I am, so you should know, it's the term we use, it's cool. No, it's cool. So I trained as a adolescent psychotherapist, so I think it's important to name that. Like, I got a master's in clinical counseling. I also got a master's in theological studies, too. So you can probably see here in my response is traces of both of those types of things. So I wrote this with what therapists would call like empathic regard. I was writing as a writer, but also as a person who thinks very deeply about its impact on other people. Which is why it was really important for me to ground a lot of the narratives in context and to be very thoughtful about the words. So if anything, I would say I was thoughtful about the peoples, the lived experiences, the life worlds, the folk that I was writing about, and I wanted to do them justice by writing in them into being with care. I was not going to talk about Camden without giving Camden a context. I didn't want to sort of paint a picture of a little boy walking down streets where there's broken glass and drugs and all manner of shit going on without the reader realizing that their hands had something to do in the making of the ghetto to the long calculated history of political disenfranchisement. Of deindustrialization that is not just common to Camden, but to so many other places. So it was my responsibility to not allow a reader to go, oh, woe is this little boy, you know, this little magical Negro that made it up the hood and became something you can do in town. Be like him, you know? No, I wanted to show, like, the Camden is what it is because there were calculated decisions that made it that way. So that's the type of example, right? Like I talk about my mother, you know, and I describe her having me at 16 and being forced to stop going to school in 10th grade. And I describe what's happening in the world at that time because I want people to not just have this affective experience, this affecting experience, you know, where they're like feeling bad, but like, I need you to see how like the political decisions that were made, you know, the ways in which her life had been legislated as a black girl. And the fact that some of y'all reading it may have voted for the people who legislated those things. Nobody is left off the hook here, right? So I tried to balance by doing that. But what do I expect for the book to do? You know, like I write never ever disconnected from my place in the world as a writer meets organizer meets doer, thing, you know, all of those things sort of go together. And writing for me, literature, art making, is itself a tool for social transformation, yeah? Art and culture, and there are a lot of writers, thinkers who talk about this, even though I think we do ourselves an injustice for those who move within progressive movement spaces by not really giving art the type of space and cultural work the type of space that is necessary for change. You know, like, it just, it, like, I want to come to a conference where one day we just stop talking to each other, like, and stop pontificating. How about we do a damn writing workshop?
Yeah.
You feel what I'm saying? Like, this too, I mean, let's throw it out there, you know? What I'm trying to say is that I've been in too many spaces where we think the rule of the day and social transformation has comes by our pontification, our theory, our strategy in organizing, and forget the power of cultural work. Forget that people are shaped by filmic works, by visual art, by dance. I mean, shit, one time I'm like, I'm so tired, I'm tired. I'm not going to Union Square to protest another, I'm not doing it no more. But let's go, what if we partner with some of my friends that are like Dominique dancers? And just have them disrupt the space by dancing. A meditation on like black manhood and criminalization right at 42nd Street. This too is the power of art. And I want us to be more attentive to its power and to realize that it has the potential to disrupt, it has the potential to catalyze imagination, to catalyze revolution. It does, you know, like my most poignant time, like, this is gonna sound really weird, but I remember, I'm gonna admit this, I don't care. So I was in Chicago and Beyonce was in concert. I know my friend Bell Hook called Beyonce a terrorist. I love Bell Hooks, but we went to bat over that. But and I remember going to Beyonce concert, and I was here for like a convening. It was like a Movement for Black Lives convening. And I just remember like, and I love all the people, you know, I love my people. But I was like, I just need to get, I need like some music. I just need to like move my body, you know? I go to this concert, I'm with a friend, and I'm sitting there, and there was a black woman in front of me, just talking about the power of art. even if you don't like Beyonce. Don't tell me that, because then I gotta fuck you. But this black woman is sitting in front of me, and she's by herself. And she's singing these songs, and tears are coming out of her eyes. And I kept thinking, damn, even if this is not for me, somehow this black woman has found some type of liberatory something in this space. And is being moved by it, such that she's in this crowd of thousands alone, and is having experience. And it reminded me of just the power of like art as itself a tool for revolution and transformation. And I just want us to utilize and create space for that more. And to also to remember the laborers who have been doing that for so long.
Reminds me something very important about your biography that I didn't mention that is also in the book. You were one of the first organizers around the movement for Black Lives, and you talk about hearing about what happened in Ferguson to Michael Brown and getting in a car and driving. So I think one of, as it relates in particular to that movement and to police brutality, what how does that play out? Your vision, tell us.
Yeah, so just a quick aside. So before Patrice and I had organized the rides together, we had been friends for many years. So you all know Patrice Cullors is an artist. We had been partnering around her artistry work. This is far before like the sort of formal organizing began, which is a really interesting thing to point out, because now she's really been invested in her art practice. But her art practice had always been used to do the work of elevating issues in the community, particularly around the closing of jails and prisons within LA proper. But a big part of not just the sort of what happened with the Black Lives Matter network, but a lot of the Charlene Carruthers. Do y'all know Charlene Carruthers? Beyond her being a brilliant strategist, she sings. Like, we would spend time singing together. So a lot of the folk, I can go down a line of folk who are, who have brought their art practice to their work. I'm looking at Eve Ewing's like work right here in the back of this book. So many poets, so many musicians and artists and singers who have utilized their work, their artistic work to catalyze change. But that is often not the spectacular sort of talking point. It's not the thing that's often lifted up within conversations like this. In fact, you know, like, it doesn't even seem to fit like the progressive resumes of folk, when in fact it should. Because what it meant is that these art practices actually shaped these organizers in so many ways. Before I did anything, when I spent big part of my young adult youth life, I hate to admit this, I've never admit this in front of a crowd, singing. I wrote songs for artists, I've been in studios, and I remember once one of my supervisors said he thinks I'm most alive. I'm an Aquarius, so everybody think Aquarius is dead, you know. It's like, you're most alive, you seem most connected to spirit, to the world, when you are singing. And it's been like through these art practices that we've been able to do collectively and individually that has really proven the power of what it can mean. And so now, you know, even now I work within an institution that uses cultural work. New digital technologies, filmmaking, gaming, cartooning, all manner of cultural tools to do this particular type of work in the world. And it works. So the last thing I'll say is, I'm often asking myself, what do we need to create that can inspire young people? And I know for sure that many of the conversations, if I took my 14-year-old nephew to the stuff I'm part of, he would fall asleep, you know? But, you know, like when I get him like Jason Reynolds' book, you know Jason Reynolds?
Yes.
Yeah, let's call out Jason Reynolds. Like when I get him Jacqueline Woodson's book, or if I give him like this song that he doesn't know is like really like, he think it's sugar, but it really is medicine in the sugar that's teaching him something about the world. He takes it in. So a big part of my practice now is not imagining what I need to do for the sort of status quo, but what we need to do for those young people that are coming behind us. We think we are doing, let me stop saying we, I don't want to talk in generalizations here, and I don't want to offend anyone, but you know, let me just offend y'all. You know, we out here, and we like, you know, intersectionality, you know, hashtag, whatever the fucking hashtag is for this week, we're doing our work. Thinking that that's getting to the people. Because the people that we think is the people, they all in this room, the choir. If we're really about the work of changing the world, we got to be creative and think about how to get to the folk that are not in the choir stand. That's going to require creative practices. And that's when I'm like, really, like now I'm so compelled all the time. I'm like, what is it that we need to do? Do I need to create a meme, a GIF, a cartoon? To get to, I'm trying to get to that, to the folk that are not in the choir stands. And I think art is a sort of route to do that type of work. Yeah.